You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. So, what are we talking about
tonight? We're talking about relapse. You know what happened? How come someone with 10 years sobriety can have a drink, say, "I think this is a good idea," and they're off and running again? How can someone who's like, "I'm never going to use again," their best friend died, or they're, you know, they've seen it, what it's done to their family, or how can they go back out there? And one of the questions people always say is relapse is part of recovery. It doesn't really have to be.
Right.
It's not a requirement. So if you say, "Oh, I can relapse because it's part of my recovery," it's not. That's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And we want to talk about some of the warning signs and one of the, you know, experiences of people who watch their family members go through this or friends. And we have some amazing guests with us.
We have some amazing guests.
Some are in the studio right now.
I know. Two friends of ours, Peter C. Johnson, who's not only a friend, he's an office mate at Right Turn with me. Peter's alcohol and drug counselor and a relapse prevention specialist at Right Turn. He's been a member of the Right Turn team since 2005. Peter, you know this, but I'm letting everybody else know, Peter's a very successful musician, having spent 30 years in the music biz as an artist with album releases on A&M and CBS Records.
Yeah. And Peter C. Johnson, you can look him up on the web.
Peter C. Johnson, you can look him up. And then we have also Dr. George Valiant joining us on phone. Dr. Valiant is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the Department of Psychiatry at the Mass General Hospital. He has spent his research career charting adult development, the importance of involuntary coping mechanisms, and the recovery process of schizophrenia, heroin addiction, alcoholism, and personality disorders. He's published many books, including The Natural History of Alcoholism, Revisited, Aging Well, and The Triumphs of Experience. He is a past, I didn't even know this existed, he is a past Class A non-alcoholic trustee of Alcoholics Anonymous and is a fellow of the International Positive Psychology Association.
And we have Dot with us as well, and she's an all-around good soul who we really like and we've known for years,
yes,
and who has a lot to offer talking about relapse.
Yeah.
The way this whole show started is people wanted to know, can I be mad at people if they relapse? And so we're going to talk to people, we're going to give people a better idea of what relapse is and also what you can do.
So welcome, you guys.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Dot.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Abby. Hi, John.
I love Peter's radio voice.
Yeah. So, Dot, you were telling us a story about a friend of yours.
Well, there was a guy I used to know. I'm just going to call him Bobby. And I knew him from, I used to attend these anonymous 12-step program meetings. And he was a strong power of example for me. This guy really had it all down. He was really doing a great job. And then one day I found out he had relapsed, and I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And then, but he came right back. Like, he was gone for 24 hours, literally 24 hours, and then he came right back. And he had friends there who, you know, who were sober people who would went out and bought him more liquor if he wanted to do more liquor. It was there for him. You know, they weren't going to judge him. They just wanted to be there when he was ready to stop. And so he stopped and he came right back. And then after knowing him for some more years, I found out that this guy would relapse every 7 years. It was almost like, you know, his body was set to this special timer, and it would average out to about every 7 years. It was really surprising, because otherwise he worked very hard trying to stay sober one day at a time. And he was a very nice guy, and he was a great power of example.
Well, and you had said that, you know, sometimes it was like, what are some of the examples he gave?
One time, it was actually pretty scary. His wife had passed away,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't have any kids.
And that's what you expect.
And that's what set him off. And then the time before that, apparently it was just he had a bad day at work, like a really bad day at work, and he came home and he picked up. And it was no like that's why I'm saying there was like no rhyme or reason for it.
You said, you know, no rhyme or reason for it. But Peter, you talk about somebody kind of the process of relapse and how it begins sometimes months before the actual event of relapse. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes. I mean, at first, I just like to say in response to that story that addiction isn't going anywhere. This disease is going to continue to inhabit you spiritually, emotionally, biologically, and unless you're performing certain daily tasks, it can come up and bite you at any time.
Yeah.
And it sounds like your friend was just knocked off his feet by some very uncomfortable emotions that he simply didn't know how to handle. Maybe he hadn't practiced quite enough on a daily basis.
Yeah. And you hear those stories a lot. Dr. Valiant, does any of this ring true to you?
The difference between me and most people in the field is that I know how the Triple Crown turned out, and everyone else is still trying to figure out which horse is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because having followed alcoholics for 60 years and also being brought up to date on modern neuroscience, I know that some of the things, the folk wisdom out there just isn't so.
Can you explain what you mean?
First, people think that people become alcoholics because they had unhappy childhood, and they forget to ask, was a parent alcoholic?
Nicely put, yes.
If you have an alcoholic step-parent, you're not at risk for alcoholism. If you have an alcoholic real father who left your mother when you were one day old, you're at five times the risk for alcoholism. This is because alcoholism is a disease, and people who are become alcoholic aren't like the rest of us who start getting headaches and hangovers and throwing up after the third margarita,
mm-hmm.
so that they can tolerate it enough to become addicted. Point two, when I started, you know, I said alcoholism causes depression, depression causes alcoholism. I was a well-trained psychodynamic psychiatrist. That was what I was supposed to say. But after having followed alcoholics for 30 to 60 years, depression does not cause alcoholism. Depression makes alcoholism worse. Nobody, people in general, don't drink because they're depressed, because it makes their depression worse. Anybody who drinks alcoholically, who is out of control and their life is unmanageable, becomes depressed. And psychiatrists don't know the difference. So someone comes to me and says, Dr. Valiant, my wife ran off with my best friend. I'm living in a single room, and I've started to drink half a bottle of Jack Daniels a day. What can I do to feel less depressed? The answer is don't give him Prozac, but say, when your wife ran off with your best friend, did she used to nag you about your drinking? Oh, yes, I didn't have a problem, but that nag thought I drank something awful. In other words, the alcoholism was involved in 57% of our study divorces. That's in no marriage book that I know of, simply because people haven't had the chance to look at the whole picture.
Can you tell us a little about what you kind of gleaned from all this experience about relapse?
Yeah. First, words don't matter. It doesn't matter what you say, and it doesn't matter what people say to you, because addiction is in the lower part of the brain that words don't reach, that it's the instinctual part of the brain, and that's what becomes addicted to the drug, and it makes the drug very interesting and gives the drug meaning. So an alcoholic loves his Jack Daniels bottle as much as he loves his wife. And your program, by substituting words for music, is right on the money. And whether you talk about spiritual experiences, whether you talk about God, whether you talk about love, whether you talk about music, you circumvent the cortex, puts leads to the bumper sticker, don't believe everything you think. It gets to the heart of the matter. So that what you need to give someone who's about to relapse is meaning.
Right.
And that meaning can be someone suddenly calling him up and asking him to join in a chamber concert, but it also can be structured most clearly by programs like the 12-step programs that in the first three steps, they say, this is a place where you are loved. God loves you, we love you, but the only way you can be loved is to make a commitment. I just watched in church today a couple, 60 years later, restate their vows. Now that's commitment. And the average alcoholic who gets sober in AA has been an alcoholic for 20 years. And it takes lots of us 20 years to make a commitment to love. Love is scary. And to make that kind of commitment takes support. And it sounds like in your multi-day program that you try to give the person support. It gives you meaning to know that you're loved.
Now,
second step is to give something back to the world, which in AA,
this is John's favorite.
Yeah. And is there a change in the brain when you start doing things like that, Dr. Valiant?
That's not clear. There's a part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, and if you want to light that up in someone, you wave cocaine in front of a cocaine addict or Jack Daniels in front of an alcoholic, but you also can light it up by asking someone to give money. Money is given to their favorite charity, and that part of the brain lights up when couples who are in love with each other feel positive emotion.
So, Peter, is somebody doing something wrong in their recovery if they relapse? Can I blame somebody for relapse?
Well, from my point of view, yes, they're doing something wrong. They aren't performing simple daily tasks. And I can tell you about some of those, if you'd like, that have been helpful to me and helpful to my clients. And probably right at the top of my list is don't try to do this alone.
Right, and that's exactly what Dr. Valiant was saying. Be a part of something.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is research to support the fact that people who believe they're part of something greater than themselves are 27 times more likely to stay clean and sober over the long run.
Wow.
You know, now this can begin with one other person, a counselor. It can begin with a sober friend. It can carry into 12-step groups. You know, as the doctor said, a chamber group with some sober musicians. Secondly, you know, this thing about people, places, and things. It's a no-brainer.
What's that line? If you don't want a haircut, don't go to a barbershop.
Exactly.
Yes. If you don't want a drink, don't go to a bar.
Yeah.
Exactly. We need to stay away from people who are dangerous to us. We need to stay out of the old bars. Sometimes the old neighborhoods, if possible. You know, there's something they refer to as apparently irrelevant decisions. Don't buy your cigarettes in a liquor store.
Right.
Now you tell me.
Yeah. You know, do this in increments. It's overwhelming when we look into next week or next year in early recovery. Let's try to do this a day at a time.
Yeah.
Another is stop romancing. You know, the euphoric recall. Yes, most of us had a really good time early on, but that's not how it ended.
Yeah.
Everybody's nodding.
Yeah, Dot's nodding her head.
When you catch yourself rhapsodizing about the wonderful good old days, take a closer look at how it was last week or last month. Do a little reality check.
You talk about your one friend who was on the seven-year plan. Have you seen anybody else where what Peter's saying rings true, other people that you've known?
Well, with what Peter was saying, and I would notice people would relapse when they got away from their routine of going to a meeting or talking to other people. You know, I personally have a lot of sober friends. So if I started to get out of whack, and it's happened a couple of times, usually there's somebody there to say, what's going on? You know, I mean.
Well, and what I've noticed is that people get out of meetings, what Dr. Valiant was talking about, the kind of feeling of acceptance.
Yeah, it's not what just he said meaning.
Right. You don't just go there to like hang out and listen to a bunch of people gripe. There's all of a sudden people get this feeling like, this is where I belong.
This is my tribe. That's Abby's thing.
Yes.
Yeah, find
this
your people.
This is my tribe. Yeah. Because I remember when I was getting sober, what attracted to me to that was that people were going through some very difficult things, and yet they weren't drinking. They were getting married. They were having babies. They were moving. Their parents were dying. And they didn't pick up, and they were a power of example to me.
Dr. Valiant talks about the power of positive emotions and the strengthening of the brain towards, you know, against relapse. And Peter talks about that as well. Peter, what do you talk about with that?
Well, we've all heard about Jacqueline Small at Right Turn and her wish that we all develop a positive self-affirmation that I am statements, she says, will become your reality.
Not I am an idiot, but I'm working really hard at this, sir.
Yes, and we need to gradually learn how to do some thought stopping when negative self-talk.
Well, can you give us an example of like an I am statement that you might use?
I'll tell you my own.
Please.
How about that? And I've used it for all these years. I am a sober man.
I love that.
I am a sober man, and over the years, it's taken on more meaning. Just the word man.
Right.
For example, I am behaving in my life as a man should, not the way I used to think a man should behave.
An accountable man. And we've had clients come back and say, you know, I'm doing what Peter said to do and said to try, and I'm giving myself that positive emotion in the morning and doing, you know, doing that, looking in the mirror and saying, I am a sober man in recovery or whatever it is they choose. And that really helps them. We're rewiring the neural pathways.
Hopefully.
Towards recovery. Yeah, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
And Peter, you also talk about two other things. You talk about exercise, taking care of yourself, doing healthy things.
Yeah, well, exercise, I'd be interested to hear the doctor's opinion on exercise, just in terms of self-esteem and endorphins.
Yeah, so it's really a kind of a multifaceted approach, and you really have to, like Peter said, it's a daily maintenance that you have to take care of. What role do positive emotions play in relapse prevention?
I was just busting to say that when I heard the term self-help. Our negative emotions are all about us. I am hungry for a Mac, a Big Mac. I want to buy a pretty dress at a bargain. That negative emotions bring relief, but they have no sticking power.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
All the positive emotions are not about me. So to begin with, to call AA a self-help group is really stupid. AA is as much a self-help group as a barn raising is in a Shaker village. It's everybody doing it for someone else at the same time. And exercise produces endorphins, and thinking about someone else raises endorphins.
So altruism, exercise.
The emotions, I mean, think of forgiveness, compassion, joy, love, hope. Every one of them is not about me.
Right.
You spend your day in a soup kitchen and your back hurts at the end of the day, but the weekend goes well.
Yeah.
Right.
So that positive emotions give you meaning. If I love someone, if I forgive someone, if I'm compassionate towards someone, my life has meaning. If I hate someone, if I'm ungrateful towards someone, so that AA is saying attitude of gratitude, fake it till you make it, is right on the money. That produces meaning.
So is this something, this is Abby, is this something you try to tell family members to do? To focus on the positive, or I mean, is there any advice here for family members?
I think it goes both ways. I mean, my advice to everybody on the planet is find ways of increasing positive emotion. Every great religion in the world does this. AA does this. Positive psychology does this.
You're speaking our language, Doctor. We love that. I'm just wondering, Abby, like, what can a family member do?
I mean, I
should
think,
I grab the
go drink? To Al-Anon.
Well, I mean, but what is Al-Anon? Al-Anon is your tribe. Yep. I mean, hopefully you. I mean, everybody's like, oh, I didn't like this one. Well, we say go to 90 meetings in 90 days, so you can find. So you can find your people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would recommend to get help for yourself and focus on the positive stuff that in your life.
We've got a caller on the line. Fran, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Yeah, I'd just like to get the message out that I drank for 20 years. I drank in the streets. I drank everywhere. God is, you name it. Anyway, I found out that I had hep C and cirrhosis of the liver. And last week I went to the doctor and I received the diagnosis that I have 4 liver tumors.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So sorry, Frank.
And I have 6 months to live. And I just want to get the message out that it's a losing game. You know, just look at me, you know. I had a good job working for the MBTA. I have a nice car, a nice apartment, and everything's, you know, and end up giving my car away. And
oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you for calling with that message.
Yeah, friend, we hope the best for you, and this is just a better illustration of how important it is, Peter, to stay on the beam with relapse prevention.
Peter?
Yeah, that was a very touching call, and it brings up a point that I think is just huge. And, you know, despite what football coaches and generals have historically said about never quitting, we addicts need to surrender.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, we need to accept the fact that if we pick up a drink or a drug, we are engaging in a fight we're not going to win. This is a progressive disease. And rather than starting out in early recovery or the last day of your drinking by making a grand pronouncement that you will never drink or drug again, do this every single morning. You need to surrender every single morning.
So, but some people hear surrender and they say, well, that's just a sign of weakness or I'm giving up. Is that true?
It's probably the most courageous thing a person can do.
That's a really good point.
Well, if there's a fight you can't win, you know, I mean, it's and you just give up. I mean, give up the fight, then you're, you know, I mean, all power struggles, once you're in it, you've lost. And this is like any power struggle, and, you know.
I mean, the most obvious example is that little kid in the schoolyard who gets whacked, falls down, gets up, gets whacked again, you know.
There's a better way.
There is a better way. And it's called acceptance.
Okay, now I'm going to ask a question that I think... Never ask a question you don't know the answer to, Abby.
Oh, here goes.
Can I just do one? Is it okay? What's the harm in me just picking up one beer if I'm an alcoholic or one? Dot, is it safe?
Because one is not enough. And, well, one is too many and 20,000 is not enough. You know what I mean? It doesn't, you know...
But why? Just
because you don't know what's going to set you off running. You know, I mean, it's you got to do this one day. You're surrendering every day. You're not surrendering for the rest of your life. You're just surrendering till the end of the day.
Oh, I like that.
You're not thinking about the rest of your life. You don't know what the rest of your life is going to bring. Fran is a great power of example. He's been sober now, and he's going to face this thing sober. But it's one day at a time for all of us. We don't know what tomorrow brings at all. So surrender for today, and then, well, maybe tomorrow you'll do that. But if you get down on your knees and ask for help from a power greater than yourself tomorrow and ask to stay away from a drink just for today or a drug just for today, then maybe you'll get through that day, too. And so, that's how you string them together.
So, Dr. Valiant, what happens when someone relapses, or they have can people just have one?
No.
Okay.
The task is to keep the memory green.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we don't touch hot stoves is that if we touch a hot stove, it burns. One of the most potent ways of relapse prevention is having something painful happen to you that never goes away, so that the pain with you keeps the memory green.
Mm-hmm.
Giving doctors compulsory urine tests keeps their memory green, that even one drink is going to show up in their urine and they'll lose their license to make $300,000 a year.
That would do it for me. Well, you're getting a lot of north-south nodding in here of people agreeing with you, Doctor. What can somebody do? What's real boots on the ground things that people can do to prevent a relapse?
Go to more meetings. I mean, and I'm saying that not because there's anything magic about a meeting, but it's very hard to go to a meeting once you're not terrified of being loved and terrified of admitting that you've surrendered to a power greater than yourself. Once you've overcome that hurdle, I'm not an alcoholic, and I've never been to a meeting that didn't fill me with a sense of meaning in the world. And the reason that someone picks up a drink is for the same reason that they suddenly go shopping. What they want to do is to, in a meaningless world, find something that interests them. And the primitive part of the brain loves to be interested. And cocaine is very interesting. Alcohol is very interesting. Masturbation is very interesting. And it's got no sticking power.
Yeah. And I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. But it sounds like you're saying that there's a spiritual component to this. And
I sure am.
I mean, it's great to hear somebody, as you know, with the bona fides of a man like you and a doctor like you, and to hear this stuff saying, it's just affirming what a lot of people already know, is this is what works. And Peter's talking about, here's what I can do every day to stay on the beam. Dot is talking about, here's what I've seen out on the street, here's what I see in life. And so it's nice that everybody's kind of coming together with this. Peter, give me something that I can do on a daily basis that I can do to help prevent a relapse.
Okay. Most of the people that come in to see us who've relapsed are coming in because something happened that they had an emotional response to. And picking up a drink or a drug is a wonderful strategy of escape. One of the things that I encourage people to do is begin to take a daily emotional inventory, to begin to recognize what you're feeling and to attend to it, so that when someone suddenly dies, this emotion isn't completely strange to you on every level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do this every day, it's really remarkable. Just walking down to the coffee shop, you can say, okay, what am I feeling? Where am I at today? What's causing this? Is it even within my control?
So you're doing almost a cognitive thing of like identifying what's going on with me, and just
exactly.
Instead of like being in a vacuum.
When is a person responsible for their relapse?
Yeah.
You spend all this time telling people that it still hurts you when they do these relapses. So, Dr. Valiant, do you have any idea of how to answer that kind of question?
Well, I think it's very much like a diabetic, that when a diabetic relapses, you can say, well, it's their fault for not taking their insulin, but it's terribly important to take proper and loving care of them, and then go over with them what can they do next time to keep the memory green. How can you remember to take your insulin and floss your teeth? How can you remember to go to a meeting and remember savoring is important. Savoring is remembering the good things that happened to you in your last meeting. Part of alcoholism is resentments, and when an alcoholic gets a resentment, then screw them, I'll pick up a drink, rather than I'm going to fake an attitude of gratitude and force myself to think about something nice that someone did to me.
I mean, I like that, focusing on that part of it. And it's one of the things I try to do when I work with families, is try to get them to remember, how were things good when you were sober? You know, let's focus on the positive parts and let's try to work that in. One of the things that I got a lot of questions about, and you guys have all heard these, is what if I just lock up the liquor? People want to know whether or not they can actually just prevent someone else from using. And you can't really prevent it. But, you know, one of the things Peter was talking about...
It makes a difference.
Then that's
probably
the point.
Good for diabetics not to work in sweet shops.
Right.
And buy your cigarettes not in the liquor store. So that temptation is not conscious. I mean, this is how advertising works. Is by playing on the hidden persuaders.
Right. And people are always saying, well, there had to be something I could have done to make him not relapse, her not relapse. One of the problems when people come back from a relapse is the guilt and the shame they give. Peter, is it ever possible to get something positive out of a relapse?
Absolutely positively, yes.
We don't recommend them, though.
No, we don't recommend them, but we love to learn from them.
There you go. And we've seen it time and again where somebody, you know, you're really not doing it. The only thing you haven't done right is not come back, you know. And you have a prolapse?
A prolapse.
So explain what that means a little bit, please.
Well, you know, it's very helpful. I know when I'm sitting down with someone who's relapsed to kind of review what their past couple of weeks have been like and learn where things began to break down. I mean, it can be a wonderful, wonderful learning experience.
Yeah, it really can.
Well, but I think the one thing that we all have really come to agree with is that there's a lot of joy in recovery. And, I mean, that's kind of our whole belief system about at Right Turn, is about engaging people and not getting mad at them for using. Remember that nobody sits around. I know it's just the ad, but nobody woke up this morning and said, ooh, I want to wreck my life and become a drug addict.
Right.
They sit there and say, I want to do something right. So we need to focus on what people are doing right and help them find their little creative selves.
And you have to make it, you know, you have to make recovery attractive to people to make it sustainable and make it something more fun than what they want to do.
And Dr. Valiant, you've just finished a book, or you?
I wrote a book called Triumphs of Experience. And the bottom line is that you don't get happiness by doing things for yourself. You get happiness and meaning by doing things for other people, that meaning in life, and this is how we're hardwired to survive a million years ago, is that what gives us meaning, what gives us joy, is not taking drugs or getting the biggest piece of pie. It's taking care of our families, and that gives us, I mean, again, forgiveness, compassion, gratitude, joy, love. They all go the same way. They're all not about me.
Thank you, Dr. Valiant. I have heard you interviewed before, and this has been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Dr. Valiant. I'd like to thank also our very good friend, Dot.
Thank you.
You're awesome. We love you.
Glad to be here.
And Peter C. Johnson. And it's just been a great show.
Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.